Now, last week, we began a new section in the class. If you don't have an outline, you may want to get one from the table over there so that you can take notes. And this is on the doctrine of creation. And we began by explaining why this is an important doctrine by contrasting it with non-biblical perspectives on the world, such as dualism or monism. And we explained that in the biblical view, the world is not something that is set over against God as an independent, eternal, self-existent reality, nor is it a manifestation of God in the sense of being divine, being an expression of his being, or being merely an illusion, as in Hinduism or other monistic beliefs. Rather, the world is a creation of God. It is distinct from God, but real and dependent upon him for its existence. And we began to look at the Christian doctrine of creatio ex nihilo, or creation out of nothing. This is the Christian doctrine that says that God made the world, God is the cause of the world, but that he did not use any sort of material stuff to make the world. He brought the universe into being without any kind of material substratum substance. And we began to look at the biblical basis for this doctrine by examining the first verse of the Bible, Genesis 1:1, which says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." Now, in the Hebrew, this is Bereshith Bara Elohim. In the beginning, or beginning, created God. And the rest of the verse then goes on, Hashemaim Ve'et Haaretz, or the heavens and the earth, which is a Hebrew expression for the world, the universe. In the beginning, God created the universe. Now, the question is, how do you understand this first sentence? Traditionally, it's been understood to be an independent clause, which states that there is an absolute beginning of the universe and that it is the creative product of God. But certain commentators suggested that verse 1 should not be understood as an independent clause, but rather as a subordinate clause, meaning something like this. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, and then it goes on to the main clause in verse 2, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And by interpreting Genesis 1:1 as a subordinate clause rather than an independent clause, it might make it appear that it is not a creation out of nothing after all. Rather, when God began to create, there was already this formless, primordial, uninhabitable earth or water, these primordial depths that already existed, and that God then simply brings order out of chaos, as is described in the remainder of the chapter. So the really crucial question here is whether or not we should be understanding this first sentence in the Genesis 1:1, Bereshit bara Elohim, as an independent clause or as a subordinate clause. And as I indicated last week, there has really been, I think, a new consensus emerging on this question by commentators that, in fact, the traditional understanding of this as an independent clause has been emerging. And I'm going to share with you some of the arguments here from Klaus Westermann and his commentary on Genesis 1-11. And Westermann makes the following 6 points in defense of taking verse 1 as an independent clause. And you'll want to get your Bible, if you have it with you, to look at what he has to say. First of all, he points out that there's no reason to think that Bereshith, the word for beginning, cannot be used at the beginning of a sentence to indicate an absolute point in time, an absolute origin of the universe. For example, look at Isaiah chapter 46:10 for a similar use of this word. Isaiah chapter 46 and verse 10. There the prophet says, in the name of God, I am God, there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things not yet done. There Bereshith is used to indicate a sort of absolute beginning and shows that it could be used similarly here in Genesis 1:1 to indicate an absolute beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This conclusion is also supported by the earliest Old Testament translations, which translated this always as an absolute beginning, in the beginning. Also, the earliest Hebrew text with the vowel points, it's called the Masoretic text. Let me explain that. Hebrew is a language that is composed of consonants. It doesn't have any vowels in it. The Hebrew alphabet is just consonants. And so the original Hebrew text is just consonants, and you have to kind of fill in the vowels yourself based upon the spelling of the consonants. But the Masoretes were early scribes who added vowel points to the text. And these vowel points would be tiny little dots and dashes under the consonants or around them to indicate what the sounds would be when you would speak the text orally. And in the Masoretic text, the way they punctuate or vowel point Bereshit bara Elohim is to indicate an absolute beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So the earliest translations of the Hebrew text, the earliest Masoretic vowel pointing on the text also indicate an absolute beginning. And as we'll see later on, the authors of the New Testament, when they read their Hebrew Bible, also took this to indicate an absolute beginning. So the first point that Vestermann wants to make is that Bereshith can be understood here to indicate an absolute beginning of the universe, and that is how it was traditionally understood. Second, he points out that the grammatical syntax of verse 1 does not suggest that we should understand this to be an adverbial subordinate clause. Now, those who say that this is an adverbial clause, a kind of subordinate clause, could appeal to Hosea chapter 1 and verse 2 in support of their position. So let us just turn over to Hosea chapter 1 and verse 2, where we see a kind of similar adverbial subordinate construction to what we have in Genesis chapter 1. In Hosea chapter 1 and verse 2, you have in your English Bible, when the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said. And the construction there is just like in Genesis 1:1. And it doesn't mean in the beginning God spoke to Hosea. The way it's translated is when the Lord first spoke to Hosea, the Lord said. And so those who want to take this as an adverbial subordinate clause could appeal to Hosea chapter 1 and verse 2 in support of their position that this is an adverbial subordinate clause, not an independent clause. But what Vestermann points out is that it's illegitimate interpretation of literature to compare what the author of Genesis says with what the author of Hosea says in order to interpret Genesis. You can't interpret the author of Genesis by seeing how Hosea wrote and the way he used certain constructions. Rather, Genesis needs to be interpreted in terms of itself. And when you look at how the author of Genesis wants to express this sort of subordinate clause, he doesn't use an adverbial subordinate clause. He uses an infinitive clause. And I want to give an example of this in Genesis chapter 5 and verse 1. The second half of that verse, Genesis chapter 5 and verse 1. When he wants to express a kind of subordinate, circumstantial idea, this is the way the author of Genesis does it. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. And what he uses here is not an adverbial construction. Rather, what he uses here is an infinitive for expressing the subordinate clause. So if you read Genesis, in light of Genesis, if the author in chapter 1 wanted to express the idea of when God created the world in the beginning, he would have used an infinitive clause like he does in chapter 5 and verse 1. You can't interpret him in light of Hosea. You have to interpret him in light of his own style. So the second point that Vestermann wants to make is that when you interpret Genesis in light of the author's own style, you see that he expresses a circumstantial idea by using a different grammatical construction than what we have in verse 1. Third point, he says that you cannot determine, based upon theological arguments, whether or not the author is wanting to express creation out of nothing or not. You can't import theological arguments to make this decision. Simply because we don't know what the author's theology is until we interpret the writing, till we interpret the passage. And so we must do, he says, an exegesis of Genesis 1 in order to determine what the author means. You can't presuppose in advance that the author doesn't have any idea of creation out of nothing and try to impose your theology on it. So, number four, fourth argument is, when you do carry out an exegesis of Genesis chapter 1, what you discover is that Genesis 1:1, chapter 1, verse 1, has no parallel in ancient creation stories. When you look at ancient creation myths from the pagan religions around Israel, you find nothing parallel to Genesis 1:1. What Vestermann points out is that the usual form of these creation myths was something like this. When blank was not, then God did, and then fill in the blank. The typical form of these ancient creation myths was when something was not yet, did not yet exist, then God acted to do something. And so it would express perhaps that there was a not yet perhaps life, or there was not yet light, or something of that sort, and then it would describe how God acted to change the situation. The first clause would express the circumstance, when something was not yet in existence, and then the second clause would express what God did to bring order out of that state. And he points out that we find this typical sort of construction in Genesis chapter 2. Look at Genesis chapter 2 in verse 5 through 7. Genesis chapter 2, verse 5 to 7. When no plant of the field was yet in the earth, and no herb of the field had yet sprung up, and then in verse 7, then the Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground, etc., etc. There you have the typical formula that appears in these ancient creation stories. When blank was not yet, then God did blank. So that would be the typical form that you would find in ancient creation stories. And Vestermann thinks that what the author of Genesis 1:1 did was he took this typical formula, when blank was not, then God did blank, and he used it to as verses 2 and 3 in Genesis chapter 1. Notice what it says in Genesis 2. The earth was without form and void. Darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And so he took this typical formula and used it to make verses 2 and 3 of Genesis chapter 1. And then he prefixed this with verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And as such, verse 1 stands completely outside this typical formula. It precedes this typical formula and is independent of it. And therefore, as Vestermann says, and I quote, it acquires a monumental importance which distinguishes it from other creation stories. He says verse 1 has no parallel in the other creation stories, while all three sentences of verse 2 are based on traditional material. He says the tradition history of the creation stories provides us with an answer to the question about the interrelationship of the first verses of Genesis, which is certain. So that's a very strong statement. He says it is certain that what we have in Genesis 1:1 is an independent, self-standing clause because it stands outside this typical formula that is represented in verses 2 and 3. And finally, the fifth argument that he gives is that the style of the author of Genesis also favors taking verse 1 as a main clause. He says it would be completely out of harmony with the author's style in Genesis 1 to arrange the first three verses in one complete sentence. It would be a long, rambling sentence if you tried to interpret verse 1 as a subordinate clause. And that supports the idea that it is a main clause that is independent of verses 2 and 3, and therefore does represent an absolute initial event of creation. In the beginning, God created the universe. Now, is there any question about that first general point as to why we ought to understand verse 1 to be a main independent clause and not a subordinate clause? Yes, James? Yes, that's true. There are those who say that you have two creation accounts, one in chapter 1, one in chapter 2, but that wouldn't be pertinent to the issue that we're dealing with. I mean, on the contrary, in the account in chapter 2, you do find this typical formula, don't you? In the account in chapter 2, you find this formula. In chapter 1, though, you don't find that formula, except in verses 2 and 3. Verse 1 prefixes that, and therefore stands apart, is independent, and according to Vestermann, is unparalleled in ancient creation stories. There's nothing like it. So I think it would only reinforce the point that he was making. Yeah, well, I would take it that the author is trying to make a theological point. The more you study Genesis chapter 1, you begin to realize that this isn't just sort of a bare police report. This is a story that is filled with theology and is intended to be a counterblast to the mythology and the creation myths of Israel's ancient neighbors. You remember we talked a little bit about last week how some of them thought of the world as being created out of the body of a dragon and out of the blood and the seeds of these primordial beasts, and in these ancient creation myths, the sun and the stars were worshipped as deities. And what you have in Genesis 1:1 is a kind of demythologization of these ancient creation stories. The sun and the moon just becomes things that God made, lights. That's all they are. God has created everything. There's nothing over against God that he is warring with or fighting with. Genesis 1:1 is such a terse and beautiful statement of creation. In the beginning, God created the universe. And so I think that that he's making a theological point here by prefixing the typical formula with this first verse. Namely, he is asserting the supremacy the ultimacy and the unique sovereignty of Israel's God as the creator of everything. Yes, way in the back. Yeah, no, I don't buy that, frankly. As I say, the word Bereshit simply means beginning. And that was Westermann's first point, is that there's no basis for thinking this cannot designate an absolute beginning, as in Isaiah 46:10. And moreover, the expression, the heavens and the earth, doesn't just mean the world as we know it. There is no word in Hebrew for the universe. The heavens and the earth meant everything there is. And so I think that what we have in verse 1 is a statement that in the beginning, God created the universe. So it's the beginning of the universe. Now, that doesn't preclude that there might not be a gap between verse 1 and verse 2. And we'll deal with that in a moment. But I don't think you can try to support that view based on the vocabulary. I don't think the vocabulary supports that. Well, no, that was one thing that John pointed out after class. Even if you take it as a subordinate clause, that doesn't show that creation ex nihilo is not in view here. But I don't think it is a subordinate clause. And as Paul Copan, my co-author in the book Creation Out of Nothing, has documented, more and more Old Testament commentators are coming to realize that the traditional understanding is, in fact, correct. And that we're not dealing here with a subordinate clause. You're dealing here with an independent clause. All right, now that doesn't... yes, one more question. Uh-huh. Yes. Well, John 1:1, as we'll see later on, ties in with this in that John's gospel begins with the words in Greek of the same words that Genesis 1:1 begins with. In the beginning... God. And here it's, in the beginning was the Word, and then he identifies the Word with God. So that's why I said earlier that the authors of the New Testament, as well as the oldest translations of the Old Testament and the Masoretic text, all took Genesis 1:1 as describing an absolute beginning. And John 1:1 would be an indication of that, because John 1:1 is also talking about an absolute beginning, in which the Word exists, and then all things came into being in verse 3 through the Word. So John is looking back to Genesis chapter 1 and imitating it and recalling it. Now, this conclusion doesn't quite settle the issue, however, in favor of creation out of nothing. Because even if we take verse 1 to be an independent main clause, we still have to ask ourselves, well, what is the relationship of that clause to the rest of the chapter? Now, one might say, well, in the beginning, God created the stuff, the matter and energy, out of which he then formed the universe. That the relationship here is chronological. In the beginning, God created the sort of material, the matter and energy. And then in verse 2 and following, it describes how he shaped and formed that into a world, into a cosmos. But it has been objected against this understanding, two points. First of all, the expression, the heavens and the earth, in verse 1, doesn't just designate the totality of things, but it means an ordered cosmos. That already in verse 1 you have an ordered cosmos considered, not just a kind of stuff. And in any case, and this is the second point, the creation of a chaos would be a contradiction in terms for a Hebrew thinker. God doesn't create a chaos. God is a God of order, and he would create an ordered cosmos. And so because of those difficulties, some people have said we should understand verse 1 to be a sort of title for the whole chapter. It's a sort of subheading for the chapter. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's the title of the chapter. And then the act of creation really begins with verse 2. The earth was without form and void. Darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the waters. And again, you're back to saying, well, wait a minute, maybe this isn't creation out of nothing after all. If creation begins in verse 2, then what we're talking about again is God is standing over against these primordial depths and over against the darkness and is shaping this primordial darkness and chaos into an ordered cosmos. And so one might say that if we take verse 1 to be just sort of a subheading or a title to the chapter, then it's not clear that we're back, we really have creatio ex nihilo. Well, how might we respond to this? Well, a great German commentator of the last century, Franz Delitzsch, pointed out that that verse 1 cannot be understood to be merely a heading or a title of the chapter. And the reason is that in the Hebrew, verse 1 is connected to verse 2 by the Hebrew word wa, or and. Now, this is sometimes left out in English translations, such as mine, but the verse literally reads, or the Hebrew reads, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. My translation leaves out this word in the translation, but it's there in the Hebrew. So it cannot be simply a chapter title because it's connected grammatically to verse 2 by the conjunction and. Now, what Delitzsch understood simply from his mastery of the Hebrew language has actually been demonstrated more rigorously by computer-assisted studies of the Hebrew language. My Old Testament colleague at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, when I was teaching there, John Salehammer, carried out such computer-assisted studies of Hebrew. John Salehammer, a very fine Old Testament scholar, and has written a commentary on Genesis. And what he pointed out is that in Hebrew, whenever you have a construction, which is this Hebrew word wa or and, which is then followed by a non-predicate, like, say, a subject of a sentence, and then that is followed in turn by a predicate, by a verb, so that you would have a clause here, and then a non-predicate, a subject, and then a verb. Whenever you have that construction in Hebrew, then the preceding clause, the material that goes before the and, always is something that supplies background or circumstantial information. In other words, it is not, in verse 1, a title for the whole chapter. Rather, it is giving background information to verse 2. And according to Salehammer, when I examined him on this, I pressed him on the point, he said this is always the case. Computer-assisted studies of Hebrew language show that this is always the case. And I think that settles it decisively, that verse 1 cannot just be interpreted to be a heading for the chapter or some sort of a title. Rather, this is a conjunction. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void. And verse 1, preceding the word and, therefore provides background information to what is going on in verses 2 and 3. Is there any question about that point? Yes, John? Right. Well, you asked whether this matters apologetically. I would say apologetically, it could matter in the sense that if it is that God created the sort of matter and energy that then he fashioned into a world, that would be very compatible with contemporary cosmology. I mean, when you think of contemporary Big Bang cosmology, that's exactly what's described. In the beginning, there was light, photons. That was what God created in the Big Bang. And then as the universe cooled down and expanded, big planets, stars, and so forth began to form. So apologetically, if this interpretation is right, it would be much more consonant than Big Bang cosmology. But notice the way I'm approaching this chapter is not via apologetics. I think it's bad interpretation to try to read modern science into Genesis. What we want to do is let the text speak to us on its own terms. How would an ancient Hebrew understand this text? And I think some of you attend Reasons to Believe with Hugh Ross. I think this is one of Hugh's weak points, is that Hugh tends to read science back into the text rather than allowing the text to speak to us first. And so my conclusions aren't driven by what would be apologetically useful here, but rather by what does the text say, and that's why we're doing this detailed grammatical exegesis. So I do think that Genesis 1:1 is describing sort of background to the formation of the cosmos in verse 2. Now, is there any other question about that before I go to the next point? Yeah, way in the back. Yes, what? Yes? It's the word in Hebrew is Hashamayim Ve'et Ha'aretz, the heavens and the earth, or the land. That's literally what it says. But that is an idiom for expressing everything, since they didn't have a single Hebrew word for universe. Now, what about the tension that exists between verses 1 and 2 then that I mentioned? That the claim that, well, you can't have a creation of some sort of unformed stuff because the heavens and the earth already designate a formed cosmos. Well, one could say, well, this tension between verses 1 and 2 is just the result of the author's prefixing verse 1 in front of this traditional formula, the when blank was not yet, then God did blank. And so this tension is created by the author's desire to express creation out of nothing and sticking verse 1 at the beginning. And so it's just a reflection of the author's desire to show creation out of nothing. But I think that probably more could be said about that. I think that we don't have to just simply leave the tension unresolved between verses 1 and 2. I think that when you look at the chapter closely, we could take the scope of verse 1 to be universal, and then in verse 2 you have a dramatic narrowing of the focus to the earth. In verse 1, what we have expressed is, in the beginning God created the universe. And then suddenly a dramatic focusing down on the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. So that what you have here is a contrast of generality. The first verse is universal in its scope. The second verse is narrowly focused upon what happens on earth. And the expression that the earth was without form and void, in Hebrew, this is tohu wa bohu. I remember when Jan and I first came to Germany to study with Wolfhard Pannenberg, Frau Pannenberg said something about his office being a tohu wa bohu, without form and void, sort of a chaos. But in fact, this expression in Hebrew doesn't describe a primordial chaos in the Greek sense. Of unformed, chaotic confusion. It's not a Greek chaos in that sense. Rather, to say that something is tohu wa bohu in Hebrew simply means that it is the earth is an uninhabitable waste. That's the sense in which it is without form and void. It means it is an uninhabitable waste. A desert could be described in this way. In fact, there are places in the scripture where the wilderness, the desert, is described in exactly these terms, an uninhabitable wasteland. So that it is not a chaos that is described in verse 2. It is an uninhabitable place. And what you then have in the succeeding verses is a description of how God transforms this uninhabitable waste into a beautiful garden for human beings to live in. He transforms it into a place for man to live. Now, just in answer to the question that was posed earlier, and that would, in fact, or could, in fact, presuppose a tremendous time gap between verses 1 and 2, couldn't it? I mean, I'm not saying that the author is thinking of it, but it could. If verse 1 were to describe, say, the Big Bang, in which God created all the matter and energy in the whole universe, and then in verse 2, the focus narrows to what he is doing to transform the earth to make it a habitable place for humanity, there could be a huge time gap between verses 1 and 2. So I think that if we understand this to be a change of focus from universal to earthly or terrestrial, who knows how much time there might be between verses 1 and 2. Now, is there any other question about that point? Yes, Jim? Yeah. Yes, yeah, Jim says, how else could he have expressed the idea of an absolute beginning better than this? I think that's absolutely right. Yes, way in the back. I don't think that's heretical at all. She suggests, could it be that what is described in verse 1 would be what modern cosmologists would say is the Big Bang? And then in verse 2, what is described is God's creation of the earth as a planet to be habitable for humankind. I don't think that's heretical at all. On the contrary, I think that's very plausible. And in fact, here's an interesting suggestion for those of you who are six-day creationists who want to interpret Genesis 1:1 as describing six literal days. This exegesis would allow that there was a huge time gap between the Big Bang and the planet Earth, and then in six literal 24-hour days, God made the Earth into a habitable place for humanity. So you could actually combine six-day creationism with Big Bang cosmology in that way. Now, I don't know of anybody who does that, but you could do it if you want to have a gap in between verses 1 and 2. So, no, I don't think that that's disallowed by the text at all. Right. Yes, and we will be saying more about this later on, because we want to talk a little bit about what is the scientific evidence for creation, and how does it comport with the biblical text. But the first thing we want to do is to try to understand the biblical text. Yes? Right. In other words, this kind of expression, without form and void, doesn't describe the kind of chaos that you have in Greek mythology, where there's no order, there's no laws of nature, say. Rather, it would be the kind of disorder that you would find in a desert, where it's just uninhabitable. But obviously, there's order there. There's sand grains, there's, you know, laws of nature that operate. So there is order in verse 2, but it's not habitable. There aren't any plants yet. There aren't any human beings. There's no place to live. So but it's not a chaos in the sense of no laws of nature and no form at all. Yes? The question was, could we exclude the possibility that as God created, the laws might have shifted, that perhaps God made new laws of nature along the way or something of that sort?
That's significant to me because science and everything has always worked the same.
Right.
If that's Luther validity.
Yeah. He's saying that, so those who couldn't hear, science presupposes in doing cosmology that the same laws of nature that we observe today held right back to the beginning and operate back to the earliest times. And if God were to have changed them along the way, then that inference would fail. Well, that's obviously correct, that if the laws of nature were changed in the past, then any inferences we had would be undermined. But I don't think you're going to find any basis in the biblical text for thinking that God did such a thing. I mean, this author is not thinking in terms of things like laws of nature and so forth. That was my expression that I brought in. So your only motive for doing that, I think, would be some kind of an apologetics motive, that if somehow the Bible were to look incompatible with modern science, you would try to undermine modern science by saying God changed the laws of nature. To me, that would be a very radical move that one would rather prefer to avoid. It's sort of like saying, well, maybe God created the world 5 minutes ago, with all kinds of built-in appearances of age, the whole thing is a deception. Changing the laws of nature rather smacks of that same sort of idea. So I think one would want to avoid that if we could. So hang on to that, and we'll see if we can avoid that. All right, now, to conclude or draw together the strings of this conversation, I think what we've seen then is that in Genesis 1:1, we have neither a subordinate clause nor a mere chapter title, but rather we have a conjunction here that describes the background of God's creating the universe, and then a shift in focus to his creating life on earth. Now, there is an objection to understanding it this way, however. Namely, if you look at the first chapter, in the description of the fourth day, we seem to have described the creation there of the sun and the moon and the stars. So that it's not simply talking about creating life on earth, making life habitable on earth. It appears that on the fourth day, that's when God made the stars and the sun and the moon. And that would be sort of out of sync with having made these other things first. So how will we deal with that question? Well, that will be the issue that will occupy us when we meet together next time.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig.